This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we begin by interviewing constitutional law scholar Professor Marjorie Cohen about the likely impact of some recent and shockingly conservative U.S. Supreme Court rulings.
Professor Cohen also described some of the radical proposals contained in the now much-discussed Project 2025 and what it would mean for the lives of most Americans if we were under a new Trump administration. Now on Law and Disorder, instead of the big picture, we look at opposition to Israel's war in Gaza from a very singular and very personal point of view.
We'll do so by talking with Larry Hebert, a 26-year-old U.S. Air Force airman, about his protest and hunger strike in opposition to that war.
Stay with us.
I'm Stephen Rohde, retired civil rights lawyer and author on issues of civil liberties.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
The U.S. Constitution created three branches of the federal government to serve as a check on one another. In particular, the judiciary was intended to ensure that the actions of the executive and legislative branches did not violate the Constitution. But what happens when the Supreme Court is in the grip of a highly partisan, result-oriented supermajority, half of whom were appointed by a president who has been convicted of 34 felonies and faces 57 more felony charges in three different criminal prosecutions, but claims absolute immunity for whatever he did while in office? And on top of that, this ex-president, Donald Trump, is a nominee for president of the United States and has promised to terminate the Constitution. Meanwhile, in an almost 1,000-page blueprint entitled Project 2025, Mandate for Leadership, The Conservative Promise, a group of conservative organizations spearheaded by the Heritage Foundation has laid out a detailed plan under which the president would acquire almost dictatorial power over the entire federal government. To discuss the Supreme Court, Project 2025, and how we can fight back, we've turned to an expert who is no stranger to Law and Disorder, Marjorie Cohen. She was a co-host of Law and Disorder for 2.5 years and has been a guest several times. Marjorie is a professor of law emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law, former president of the National Lawyers Guild, and is also dean of the People's Academy of International Law and a member of the Bureau of the International Association of Democratic Lawyers. She writes frequent articles about the Supreme Court and other topics for Truth Out. Marjorie, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thanks so much, Steve and Jim.
Marjorie, since former President Donald Trump appointed three right-wingers to the Supreme Court, thereby solidifying a 6-person conservative supermajority, the court has issued several reactionary rulings. What do you consider the most egregious recent rulings of the Supreme Court, and why do you think they pose a threat to our constitutional democracy?
Well, Steve, I have to say it's hard to whittle down what the worst are because there are so many terrible ones. But of course, last term, the Supreme Court overruled the Roe v. Wade decision in Dobbs and held there's no constitutional right to abortion. Now, they wrote that nothing in the opinion should cast doubt on precedents that don't concern abortion, but the dissenters were not convinced. They said no one should be confident that this majority is done with its work, and the right to abortion enshrined in Roe is part of the same constitutional fabric as the rights to contraception and same-sex marriage and intimacy. And they wrote either the mass of the majority majority's opinion is hypocrisy or additional constitutional rights are under threat. It's one or the other. Well, Clarence Thomas wrote in his concurrence that the court should reconsider the right to contraception, to same-sex sexual conduct, and the right to same-sex marriage. Then we have a 6-3 ruling with the reactionary supermajority of the court ruling in Department of State versus Munoz, basically that U.S. citizens have no constitutional right to have their non-citizen spouses enter the U.S., so the government doesn't have to give a reason for excluding them, and that places the right to marriage equality squarely on the chopping block. Then we have City of Grants Pass, Oregon versus Johnson, another 6-3 atrocity where the Supreme Court upheld ordinances in a southwest Oregon city that prohibit people who are homeless from using blankets, pillows, or cardboard boxes for protection from the elements while sleeping within the city limits. And Sotomayor wrote the dissent on behalf of her and Kagan and Jackson that this leaves the most vulnerable in our society with an impossible choice, either stay awake or be arrested. Then the six reactionary members of the court put the final nail in the coffin of the Chevron case, which dramatically curtailed the part of federal agencies to interpret the statutes they administer. The court ruled that courts should provide their own interpretations of ambiguous statutes, and this decision will imperil the rights of workers and consumers and threaten the environment and our health and safety, all while providing a boon to corporations. Courts have used this Chevron deference to uphold a National Labor Relations Board decision that certain workers constitute employees entitled to the protection of the National Labor Relations Act, to affirm an EPA rule that required states to reduce emissions from power plants, to sustain a Department of Labor interpretation of the Black Lung Benefits Act to allow coal miners with black lung disease to get compensation, and accept the EPA's revised regulations under the Toxic Substances Control Act to provide enhanced protection from lead paint exposure. Now corporations will take aim at labor regulations that protect workers. Banks and financial services companies will weaken consumer protections, and the fossil fuel industry will resist regulations that impact their bottom line. Could affect the way insurance is administered by Medicare, Medicaid, and the Affordable Care Act. And perhaps the most shocking decision was the very recent Trump versus U.S., where the 6-member supermajority basically held that U.S. presidents are now kings. Henceforth, a president will have absolute immunity from prosecution for official acts done in the course of carrying out his constitutional powers or implementing a federal statute. And that means, well, John Roberts, who wrote the majority opinion, he's the chief, said that the president is absolutely immune from criminal prosecution for conduct within his exclusive sphere of constitutional authority. That includes commanding the armed forces, granting pardons, appointing ambassadors and members of the Supreme Court, overseeing international diplomacy and intelligence gathering, terrorism, trade, and immigration. There is no immunity for unofficial acts, but the majority admitted that it's hard to distinguish official from unofficial acts. So Sotomayor wrote in her dissent on behalf of the three liberals, the court effectively creates a law-free zone around the president. It will lie about like a loaded weapon for any president to use for their own political gain or financial interests, with knowledge that they're inoculated from criminal liability. She wrote that when a president uses his official powers in any way, he'll be immune from criminal prosecution. And then she noted, quote, orders the Navy SEAL Team 6 to assassinate a political rival? Immune. Organizes a military coup to hold on to power? Immune. Takes a bribe in exchange for pardon? Immune, 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 immune. And they also did away with affirmative action, and on and on and on, Steve.
Well, Marjorie, Jim Lafferty, good morning to you. takes your breath away, what you've already recited for us. And this is not the end, is it? Because you've also studied Project 2025, which Steve mentioned in his introduction. Tell us, therefore, what you've learned, and in particular, what you've learned in terms of what it has to say about what we might expect from the Supreme Court if Project 2025 does, in fact, become the agenda.
Yes, and I should say, Jim, that Donald Trump, because there's been so much negative publicity about Project 2025, Donald Trump is trying to distance himself from it, saying, oh, I don't even know what it says, although he was intimately involved in the development of it. Basically, Project 2025 is a 920-page blueprint for a second Trump administration. It will target reproductive health care, efforts to remediate the climate crisis, immigrants, unions, civil rights for LGBTQ plus people, and administrative agencies that protect our health and safety. It's sponsored by more than 100 reactionary groups and spearheaded by over a dozen former Trump officials. Now, Trump's former budget director, Russell Vought, who wrote one section of this Project 2025, wrote, quote, "The next administration will face a significant challenge in unwinding policies and procedures that are used to advance radical gender, racial, and equity initiatives under the banner of science." Similarly, the Biden administration's climate fanaticism will need a whole of government unwinding, unquote. So they're taking direct aim at the climate change measures to prevent climate change or to halt it. The four main prongs of this Project 2025 blueprint are, first, restoring the family as the centerpiece of American life. Second, dismantling the administrative state. Third, defending U.S. sovereignty, borders, and bounty. And fourth, securing our God-given individual rights to live freely. So, of course, the Supreme Court, as I said, just overruled Chevron deference, which means now that it's going to be in the hands of the court to determine our protection of health and safety. Courts that Trump has systematically packed with right-wingers and would continue to do so in a second term. So Project 2025 would have Trump reinstitute his so-called Schedule F, which Biden eliminated. That would reclassify 50,000 of the 2 million merit-based civil service employees as political appointees who serve at the pleasure of the president without civil service protection. And basically, there'd be a massive exodus of competence. Scientific research on nuclear power, for example, would be done by incompetence. Project 2025 would strictly limit access to abortion. And Congress wouldn't have to make abortion medication unlawful because Trump's FDA could just withdraw its approval of the drug. Project 2025 advocates the creation of a Department of Life to further the health and well-being of all Americans from conception to natural death. Of course, anti-assisted suicide, anti-abortion. The new administration would explicitly state that abortion does not constitute health care, and Planned Parenthood would be prohibited from receiving Medicaid funds. Project 2025 would have Trump abolish the Department of Education, which he's been spouting now recently during the campaign. And his right-hand man Vought called the Department of Education the Department of Critical Race Theory. Project 2025 says, quote, "The noxious tenets of critical race theory and gender ideology should be excised from curricula in every public school in the country." Project 2025 would abolish Head Start, the child development program that helps break the cycle of poverty by assisting preschool children of low-income families. It would fund private school vouchers and ban all curricula that teach about slavery. And it would prohibit non-citizens from living in federally assisted housing and oppose any efforts to weaken single-family zoning. So Project 2025 reads, The next conservative president must make the institutions of American civil society hard targets for woke cultural warriors. This starts with deleting the terms sexual orientation and gender identity, diversity, equity, and inclusion, and in parentheses, DEI. They would delete gender, gender equality, gender equity, gender awareness, gender sensitive, abortion, reproductive health, reproductive rights, and any other term used to deprive Americans of their First Amendment rights out of every federal rule, agency regulation, contract, grant regulation, and piece of legislation that exists. Under Project 2025, Trump would carry out mass deportations of undocumented immigrants. He's already said he'd do that. Deploy active-duty military personnel and the National Guard to police the border and complete construction of his border wall. When the Attorney General issues a warrant for an undocumented immigrant, the current law says the immigrant may be arrested and detained. This blueprint would change may to must and require arrest and detention. A Project 2025 recommends eliminating all initiatives to combat climate change, including dismantling the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, which tracks hurricanes. It would eliminate offices in the Department of Energy dedicated to renewable energy and climate and energy research. And finally, it would slash the corporate tax rate and the capital gains tax to benefit wealthy Americans. It would tax employers on workplace benefits that exceed $12,000 per worker annually, which would lead to employers cutting back on benefits, including family health insurance. More than 15 million workers would see their benefits taxed under Project 2025. And finally, Project 2025 doesn't recommend any reforms to the Supreme Court. Why not? Because the right-wing extremists have already taken over the court.
My goodness, Marjorie, listening to you, there is such a dangerous synergy between what the Supreme Court has already done in laying the groundwork for this powerful executive branch and then the Project 2025 saying the quiet part out loud of exactly what this administration would do. The Supreme Court can be the last word on some of these issues unless there are reforms. And Joe Biden has proposed and Kamala Harris has endorsed three reforms for the Supreme Court. And we want to spend some time talking about those. First, he favors term limits for members of the high court. What exactly does he recommend? What does the Constitution say about that? And how feasible is his proposal?
Well, on July the 29th, the White House issued a release that said term limits would help ensure that the court's membership changes with some regularity, make timing for court nominations more predictable and less arbitrary, and reduce the chance that any single presidency imposes undue influence for generations to come. And I should say, Steve, that as we all know, Trump installed three radical right-wingers on the court to constitute the six-member supermajority that we have now, more than any in recent memory, more nominations than any president in recent memory. So under Biden's proposal for term limits, the president would appoint a member to the Supreme Court every 2 years, and that member would spend 18 years in active service on the high court. Some legal scholars, such as Berkeley Law Dean Erwin Chemerinsky, have said that current members of the Supreme Court may serve more than 30 years. That's too much power for too long in one person's hand. But he contends that term limits would necessitate a constitutional amendment because Article 3, Section 1 of the Constitution says the judges, both of the supreme and inferior courts, shall hold their offices during good behavior, unquote. congressional Republicans would oppose amending the Constitution to create term limits, and the amendment process is unwieldy and time-consuming. Constitutional amendments require a request by two-thirds of both houses of Congress or two-thirds of the states at a constitutional convention. Then, three-quarters of the state legislatures or three-quarters of conventions convened in each state have to agree to ratify the amendment. But several prominent constitutional scholars disagree with Chemerinsky. For example, the Brennan Center for Justice wrote a comprehensive report that said that 18-year active term limits for members of the court is consistent with the Constitution's text and structure and with the ways in which Congress has long regulated the court, including the existing system of senior judges. And 50 constitutional law professors proposed that Congress pass a statute to enact term limits for members of the Supreme Court. Even assuming that term limits could be enacted without a constitutional amendment, the currently hopelessly polarized Congress is unlikely to enact that legislation anytime soon. There are two bills pending, one in the House and one in the Senate, that I should mention. H.R. 5566, pending in the House, which has, last time I checked, 49 co-sponsors. H.R. 5566 is called the Term Act. It would allow presidents to appoint one member of the court every 2 years, and for that member to spend 18 years in active service. It would also require current members of the court to assume senior status and as regularly appointed members receive their commissions. In the Senate, we have S-3096 with 9 co-sponsors, and S-3096 would permit presidents to appoint a member of the Supreme Court every 2 years, but allow only the 9 most recently appointed members or those appointed in the last 18 years to hear cases from the Federal Appeals Court, which is the bulk of the High Court's docket. Members appointed earlier would be limited to hearing cases over which the Supreme Court has original jurisdiction, that is like disputes between states. They could also serve as alternates for appellate jurisdiction. Appellate jurisdiction is when the court reviews decisions by lower courts. But the bill wouldn't take effect until the next presidential term after it becomes law. It would preserve life tenure for Supreme Court members by allowing them to continue to hear original jurisdiction cases and exercise other powers after 18 years. Now, let's assume that Congress did pass a term limit statute for the Supreme Court, which is highly unlikely, but let's assume that the High Court did. There's a real risk that that same Supreme Court would strike it down and say, oh, it requires a constitutional amendment.
Marjorie, I have a hunch how you're going to evaluate another proposal, the second proposal that President Biden made in this regard. He proposed, of course, no one is above the law amendment to the U.S. Constitution. But as I say, based on what you've just said to Steve's question, what do you think the chances would be of such an amendment being adopted?
Slim to none. This would be the no one is above the law amendment would reverse the frightening Supreme Court decision in Trump v. U.S., which essentially says the president's a king above the law. You know, absolute immunity for core official acts, presumptive immunity for other official acts. So the president would have absolute immunity for official acts in exercising his constitutional powers or implementing a federal statute. Presumptive immunity for acts committed in the outer perimeter of his official responsibility, whatever that means. The proposed amendment, very briefly, would state that the Constitution does not confer immunity from federal criminal indictment, trial, conviction, or sentencing for former presidents. And there's little chance of such a constitutional amendment for the same reasons that I cited for the term limits statute.
You're listening to Law and Disorder. Today our guest is Marjorie Cohn. We are joined by Jim Lafferty, and I'm Steve Rohde. Marjorie, the third proposal that Biden has advanced is a binding code of ethics for members of the Supreme Court. in the face of this scandal-ridden court we presently have. So that's part of what led to this suggestion. Tell us about it, and what would Biden's proposal entail?
It would require members of the Supreme Court to disclose gifts, refrain from public political activity, and recuse themselves from cases in which they or their spouses have financial or other conflicts of interest. Biden wrote that every other federal judge is bound by an enforceable code of conduct, and this code of ethical conduct would not require a constitutional amendment. I should say that the Supreme Court ethics have become a partisan issue with the ongoing revelations of extravagant gifts that Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito have received. Thomas has received nearly $4.2 million in gifts. Recently, Alito refused to recuse himself from two cases involving Trump and the January 6th Capitol rioters after the New York Times reported that flags associated with far-right causes flew over his family homes. There is a bill pending in the Senate. It's called Supreme Court Ethics Recusal and Transparency Act, S-359, or SCRT, and S-359 would require Supreme Court members, I don't say justices, you notice, I don't think they're justices, would require Supreme Court members to adopt a code of conduct, create a mechanism to investigate alleged violations of the code of conduct and other laws, improve disclosure and transparency when a member has a connection to a party or an amicus brief pending before the court, and require members to explain their recusal decisions to the public.
My goodness, Marjorie, as we know, every presidential election year, a point that is made, depending on who your candidate is, the same point is often made from both sides, that this is going to be a very important presidential election because there may be opportunities to appoint Supreme Court justices and how important that is. In light of what you've said so far, what are the stakes in this particular election for the American people when it comes to, well, the Supreme Court in November and the presidential election?
Well, if Kamala Harris and Tim Walz are elected, Biden's proposed reforms could eventually lead to the reversal of some of the court's most egregious decisions. But the adoption of those reforms faces overwhelming obstacles. Meanwhile, if Trump's elected, he would likely have the backing of the Supreme Court as he implements the Project 2025 agenda. Also, Trump may have the opportunity to replace current members of the court and actually expand the six-member radical supermajority. The liberal Sonia Sotomayor, who is in ill health, could be replaced by a right-winger. And some of the older right-wingers on the court, like 76-year-old Thomas and 74-year-old Alito, could be exchanged for younger members who could wreak havoc for decades to come. So between the makeup of its members and the lack of accountability, the stakes for the Supreme Court are enormous in the forthcoming presidential election.
Marjorie, how can listeners follow your work, and what can they do to support these Supreme Court reforms?
Well, my work is at truthout.org. It's a column called Human Rights and Global Wrongs. If you go down to the very bottom of the page, that my writings, videos, interviews, books, etc., are cataloged at my website, marjoriecohn.com. And I would urge people to contact your senators and congressional representatives and urge them to become co-sponsors on these bills, the ethical code of conduct for Supreme Court members and the term limits bills.
Marjorie, we're so grateful to have you back on Law and Disorder and for all the work you do every day to alert the American public to these threats to our constitutional democracy and to protect our individual rights. Thank you, Marjorie.
Want to double down on it. We so appreciate your work and joining us here on Law and Disorder.
Well, it's my pleasure, Steve and Jim. Thanks so much.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Israel's deadly and unrelenting assault on Gaza following Hamas's October 7 attack on Israel has had repercussions around the world. In Gaza itself, the death toll is over 40,000, and the humanitarian crisis worsens every day. In the United States, as students are headed back to campus, colleges and universities are bracing for a new round of protests and counter-protests. Israel's war in Gaza is dividing the Democratic Party, just as Kamala Harris and Tim Walz are seeking to unite their party to stop Donald Trump from returning to the White House. Recent surveys show that 48% of Americans oppose Israel's military action in Gaza, while 42% support it. But today on Law and Disorder, instead of the big picture, we're going to take a look at opposition to Israel's war in Gaza from a very personal point of view. We're joined today by Larry Hebert, a very unlikely candidate to become an outspoken protester against U.S. military support for Israel, who would gain national and international attention. Larry Hebert is a 26-year-old U.S. Air Force senior airman and avionics technician assigned to Naval Station Rota in Spain, having served 6 years so far in the military. At 10 a.m. on Easter Sunday, March 31st, 2024, on Pennsylvania Avenue in front of the White House, Hebert began a hunger strike during an authorized leave from his post in Spain. Shortly before his hunger strike, he joined Veterans for Peace, an organization that opposes U.S. military actions. The organization argues that U.S. weapons shipments to Israel is a violation of U.S. law. In a press release issued by Veterans for Peace, the purpose of Hebert's hunger strike was described as highlighting, quote, the plight of the starving children of Gaza, unquote. Hebert wore a sign that read, quote, active duty airman refuses to eat while Gaza starves, unquote, with a photograph of an emaciated Palestinian infant. Hebert said he was inspired by the self-immolation of 25-year-old serviceman Aaron Bushnell, who died on February 25, 2024, outside the Israeli embassy in Washington. Before he died, Bushnell declared he would, quote, no longer be complicit in the genocide in Gaza. Hebert's hunger strike lasted 9 days, but ended abruptly on April 9 when he was ordered to report immediately to Andrews Air Force Base for a return flight to his post in Spain. Hebert is pursuing release from active duty as a conscientious objector. Larry Hebert, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, sir.
To begin with, please tell us about yourself, your upbringing, and your attitudes toward the U.S. military back then when you signed up in 2018.
Yes, so I had a fairly pro-American upbringing. My family is right-wing and love our country and have always been strong supporters of our country and our policy. So I always had a love for this country and a respect for the military, but I never saw myself actually joining the military until I started working at a restaurant and I met a lot of veterans that had already retired and, you know, done their service. And I met people from all the branches, and all of them told me that I could really jumpstart my life and create a really solid foundation going forward if I were to join the military. And then On top of that, of course, all the benefits and the opportunity to travel and learn a trade. So I was obviously very enticed by that. And when, you know, dozens of people are telling you the exact same thing, it's kind of hard not to take that advice. So I joined mostly because of that advice. And then I also had a child on the way. So I figured, you know, working at a dead-end job isn't going to support my family going forward. So that was the real motivation for joining. And I wasn't super, like, gung-ho and you know, like, brainwashed military, but I still had a respect and underlying love for the military.
Well, Larry, this is Jim Lafferty, and it's already been said that you were inspired to take the action you took because of Aaron Bushnell and what he had done by way of killing himself, indeed, in protest of the U.S. support for Israel's war in Gaza. So describe that reaction to us. Tell us more about that reaction that, as I say, ended up inspiring you to take your own protest and your own, in your case, fast for peace.
Yeah, at the time, I was already ready to get out of the military. I thought, however, that I was just going to ride out the remainder of my contract, get out quietly. But in February, when Aaron Bushnell self-immolated, it was kind of like an inspiration. It kind of like reignited like something in me that I knew that, you know, just riding out the remainder of my contract wasn't going to be enough. Like, nobody else was going to step up to the plate and do something. And Aaron Bushnell obviously did that. He stepped up and really led this charge for service members to be speaking out. Ultimately, I waited to see what was going to be the response from the government and then within the military. Basically, both sides remained quiet about the entire situation. I was shown a letter from a representative, I believe Tom Cotton, and it was addressed to the Secretary of Defense, Austin Lloyd. I can't remember the exact verbiage, but he was basically asking him why he wasn't addressing extremism within the ranks. And I found it kind of ironic because the extremists aren't the ones that want an end to violence and an end to war. The extremists are the ones that continue violence and continue warfare and profit from it. I couldn't just sit there and just allow them to just not speak on Aaron and not highlight what he did and why he did it. So I went to D.C. pretty much immediately after about 2 weeks, and I met with organizations like Code Pink, Veterans for Peace, kind of figure out what I was going to do. I thought maybe talking to politicians might help, and that did not give me any sort of satisfaction. They're just kind of, you know, a one-line media talking points, so that was unsuccessful. And then I got to a breaking point where I thought I would ultimately have to do something enormous for media to even bother to cover it. I talked to a lot of good people that advised me, and I ultimately ended up coming up with the hunger strike, which I had done no research for previously. And I mostly was inspired to do that because of all the news articles that were coming out about the starvation that was happening in Gaza.
Larry, you mentioned Veterans for Peace. Had you known of the group before? Did you learn more about them in this connection? Tell us about the organization and what they stand for and what role they played in your decision to go to Washington.
Yeah, I had no prior knowledge of any veterans organizations prior to going to D.C. So I was actually introduced to them prior to my hunger strike by former Colonel Ann Wright. She got me connected to Veterans for Peace and ultimately connected me with pretty much everyone I know. She was a really guiding force when I was there in D.C., and it was really inspirational to hear her actions when she was serving and everything that she's done since. I was not aware of Veterans for Peace prior, but they helped me along the entire process once I did get connected with them, and they've been extremely helpful ever since. They're an organization that's been around for 40 years, and they were obviously highlighting the atrocities in Vietnam, and they've always done good things.
Larry, you obviously got some press initially on March 31st when you began your protest and your hunger strike. And I suspect in the course of that, you met a number of interesting people, or just folks walking by or others who reached out to you. Tell us a bit about how your protest went and the kinds of folks and the individuals who came up to greet you or express an opinion one way or another about what you were doing.
The protest itself was obviously a challenge that I had never done anything like that before, and I again hadn't researched hunger strikes prior, but I had a couple friends and individuals that have done hunger strikes, and they advised me a little bit on how to go about it. But the people I met during the hunger strike was probably the most interesting part of the hunger strike, because I met veterans from all sorts of wars, and I met individuals from that were displaced in Iraq and Afghanistan, and hearing their testimony and what they've been through and how they've been impacted by the U.S. military was extremely heartbreaking. And every single person I talked to that had been displaced or had family members killed through the United States' intervention, and it reaffirmed like what I was standing for, and it just continued to speak life and motivation into my message. So that's something that I'll always remember. I mean, there's a few specific individuals that I'd love to go over everybody, but I know one individual took or two individuals took train rides out to come see me in DC. I think one was from Louisiana and one was from New Jersey. That was amazing. And I had one individual, I think he ran about an hour to come see me. All the people that came out to see me, I'm highly grateful for.
Larry, how did you explain to people your decision to engage in this? What was your message? And even now, in the months that have followed, are you reinforced in what you've done? How did you talk to people you greeted? And also, how have you talked to servicemen back in Spain and others who may have contacted you?
I haven't initiated the conversation with people. I think basically everyone is aware what I did and what I was speaking out against. So I know that if I were to approach people versus them approaching me, I already know the conversation either wouldn't happen or it would just not be a beneficial conversation. So, but I will admit that I'm very surprised at how many people have come up and initiated conversations with me, and how many people have been very supportive. People I've basically never even talked to before came up to me and praised what I did and thanked me for speaking out. There's definitely an alarming number of service members that oppose the genocide in Gaza and just refuse to speak out publicly, mostly because it's a taboo topic. If you speak out against the genocide in Gaza, you're essentially speaking out against U.S. policy.
I'm Jim Lafferty, and along with Steve Rohde, we are co-hosting at this moment and talking with Larry Ebert. Larry is a member of the Air Force who went on a hunger strike in protest of the Israeli war in Gaza and the U.S. support for that war. And now, Larry, you were a member of the Armed Services, the Air Force, for some time before you decided to file a conscientious objector claim and be removed and get yourself out of military service. Can you tell us what happened to you during that period of time, what you experienced, saw, thought about during that period of time that led you to file that conscientious objector claim? and then also the current status of your application. How has the military reacted to it so far? And to your protest, for that matter, as well.
I actually looked into conscientious objector application very early on, around the November timeframe of 2023. And I knew I had to get out. But at that time, when I was initiating that conversation about conscientious objection, I didn't think I would qualify. And that was mostly due to not having a formulated opinion on national self-defense. I was very pro personal self-defense, and I thought that national self-defense was essentially the same morally. But as time went on, and once I went to DC, I started to really look back into previous conflicts and how conflicts could have been avoided entirely, and what the solution is, really, and why national self-defense maybe isn't the best option. I started looking up a lot of anti-war activists and anti-war racketeers like General Smedley Butler. I listened to multiple presidents like Kennedy, Eisenhower, and Carter, and I figured out through a lot of these resources that the whole motivation behind war is essentially for monetary gain, for the ruling class, as Aaron Bushnell would call it. There's not a true, like, enemy that we're going after. The United States is trying to obtain resources, like whether it's oil or land, and none of it is personally directed at any group of people. So I find that fairly disturbing and evil, and I think the overwhelming ignorance towards the war propaganda and the motivations of war has just continued to lead us into more and more conflicts. And now today, there's a literal genocide going on against the defenseless people, ultimately. And nobody seems to, I mean, obviously people care and have been speaking out, but there's an alarming number of people that either just don't know or just don't care.
Larry, I think anyone who listens to your story and gets to know you is impressed by your courage, given where you came from on these issues and where you've landed and the way you discuss your deeply held beliefs. Others may be listening who want to take action, who want to be courageous. Where did you find the courage in your own values to take these very visible actions, even as you are a member of the military? Tell us the exact status of your conscientious objector application and your status within the military right now.
So currently, I'm just doing menial work for the military, and my application is moving along at a fairly normal rate. I wouldn't be able to disclose exactly where it's at, just out of respect for each individual office and everyone along that process. But I think a rough projection date for approval would be around the December to June timeframe. So it's quite a bit away, but it is coming up. And then the motivating factor for me speaking out was Aaron Bushnell, and that kind of, again, it got me motivated enough to speak out and take action. But I think that I've always really stuck to my beliefs, and I've always stuck to fairness and what is right. And so I've always been a vocal advocate against immorality and wrongdoings. And I haven't been, obviously, in the news or anything doing it, just amongst my peers and coworkers. But I think it's important that people stand by their morals and stand by their beliefs, because without that, then there's honestly no point. We're just all essentially just living out our lives and just not giving a care about anything. And I think for others, I think it's extremely important too to highlight that no one person is going to change things, is going to change policy, and it's more community based. It's a collection of people. I was hoping that with Aaron Bushnell that things would change and things would end. And I was always kind of, at that time, I felt like I was always waiting for that change to happen. And that change doesn't come unless you take action. Waiting for someone else to come save the day is ultimately what's stopping change from happening. We all have to take action and be a part of change.
Larry, I wonder, you were on a authorized leave when you decided to engage in this hunger strike as your protest as to what was happening to the people in Gaza. And then that was canceled, apparently, and they brought you back into active duty. Had they not done that, had the military not that, done that, had you resolved in your own mind to continue on your hunger strike for much longer? And if so, for how long? Was it possible for you to do that in any way, shape, or form once you were brought back to the military?
I think a lot of the confusion about why I was recalled, I think a lot of people think that I was recalled because of the hunger strike and because of my protests and speaking out, speaking to media. It was actually due to me trying to address the chief of staff of the Air Force. I went to a hearing that he was speaking at, and I tried to address him, and he simply shrugged me off and ignored me. And later that evening, his office sent out a memo to my command detailing the incident in a way that really negatively highlighted me. That wasn't entirely accurate. So that was actually why I got recalled. So, but if I hadn't been recalled, I would have continued the hunger strike for as long as I could have. I know there were a lot of people that were supporting me and that were very grateful of my empathy and my courage, but some people had mentioned that I don't have to harm myself in order to make change. And that was something that really touched me, was that they, even though there's people whose family, like Palestinians, like their families that are being killed on a daily basis and are starving and dealing with injuries, they're still concerned with me. I'm obviously going to be okay. Like I'm in the United States and I had a doctor checking on me. But yeah, that was extremely impactful to be a witness to people who are undergoing a genocide and still have the empathy to say, Larry, please stop starving yourself. Like, you don't need to do this.
Larry, how can listeners learn more about Veterans for Peace? And are you on Facebook, or can people follow your case in any way?
Yeah, Veterans for Peace is on social media. There's also a website. There's a lot of different chapters kind of across the country, and everybody's kind of doing their own part that they can. And we work with all sorts of organizations that obviously work towards peace. So usually you can find the current events going on the website, but the social media obviously will have quite a bit of updates as well. And then my case, I probably won't update my case publicly until it is approved or very close to being approved.
Well, Larry Hebert, I want to thank you very much for joining us on Law and Disorder, to compliment you and salute you for standing up for what you believe in. Thank you.
Thank you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org. Thank you.
Thank you.